from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with award-winning author Caroline Leavitt, whose novel With or Without You came out in paperback last month from Algonquin Press. Caroline Leavitt is the award-winning author of 12 novels, including the New York Times bestsellers Pictures of You and Is This Tomorrow. Her essays and stories have been included in New York Magazine, Psychology Today, More, Parenting, Red Book, and Salon. She's a book critic for People, the Boston Globe, and the San Francisco Chronicle, and she teaches writing online at Stanford and UCLA. Here's a little information about With or Without You. After almost 20 years together, Stella and Simon are starting to run into problems. An up-and-coming rock musician when they first met, Simon has been clinging to dreams of fame, even as the possibility of it has grown dimmer. And now that his band might finally be on the brink again, he wants to go on the road, leaving Stella behind. But when she falls into a coma on the eve of his departure, he has to make a choice between stardom and his wife. And when she wakes, a different person with an incredible artistic talent of her own, the two of them must examine what it is that they really want. Since the book first published in 2020, it has been chosen as a Good Morning America book pick, a Pop Sugar Incredible Book, a People Magazine Best Book of the Week, one of AARP's Best Books of the Month, a Publisher's Weekly Fall Book of Note, a Public Library Association Buzzed Book, and one of LitHub's books to add to your TBR right now. My interview with Caroline Leavitt begins with my first question for her. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I know from reading that you were once in a coma and that experience, at least in part, led to With or Without You. So I wonder if we could start by just talking about that a little bit.
Sure. The coma came up about actually 25 years to July 31st after I had given birth to my first and only son. And just as I was about to go home, I suddenly looked like I was 14 months pregnant. My stomach was really hard. And the doctor just said, oh, it's probably just a blood clot from a C-section. We'll just go clean it up. Then you can go home with your baby. And then the next thing I remember is waking up. Everything went black. And then I woke up and I had no idea where I was or what was going on. And I thought I was in a TV show because there were doctors all around me and they were doing the usual, do you know where you are? Do you know what's happened to you? And I kept thinking, wow, this is like a parallel reality and I have to get out of this. And then I happened to look on the wall and there was a photograph of my baby and it was blown up. And underneath it said, get well soon, mommy, we miss you.
Oh, wow.
What is going on? And it was pretty much a nightmare for a little bit of time because I had no idea what was going on. Plus, I was heavily sedated with morphine. And the weirdest thing about it was that they gave me something called memory blockers, which I did not realize was such a thing. But they did it so I would not remember the experience. And I didn't. I was in the hospital I was in a coma for 2.5, 3 weeks. I was in the hospital for 3 months and I was sick for a year. And nobody expected me to recover, but I did recover. And the problem was I had all these post-traumatic shock things going on. Even when I was fine, I would walk into a supermarket and I would see like somebody wearing a brown and yellow striped shirt and I would have a panic attack. And my husband would say, well, that was the color of the curtains around you in the ICU.
Oh, wow.
Or like certain smells would set me off, lotions. So I went to a psychiatrist and said, I think I have post-traumatic shock and I need to figure this out. And it was the psychiatrist who said, well, why don't you write about it? You're a writer. And it's like hypnosis. The brain doesn't know the difference. So I wrote my first coma book, which was this book called Coming Back to Me, about a person just like me, you know, a young mom goes into coma. And book did fine, did well, but I did not. It did not help. So fast forward to like 5 years ago when my husband had to go to Norway for a week for, because he's an editor writer for a press thing. And I was alone and I could not sleep. I was terrified to go to sleep. And I thought, oh, this is like, you know, I stayed up all night watching movies. I saw every Jennifer Aniston movie ever made. And I would sleep in the daytime when it was light. And I thought, this is not good. I need more help. So I went to a different psychiatrist this time. And she said, well, I think you wrote the wrong book. You wrote a book about someone who is very much like you. Why don't you write a book about someone who's totally different from you? And I thought, well, you know, I'll try anything. So I created this character who was as different from me as I could imagine. She's a nurse. She's very practical. And unlike me, she remembers everything in her coma. And as soon as I started to write her experiences in the coma, I felt so happy. I felt this overwhelming relief. And I felt that I was her. And unlike me, she emerged from the coma with this talent. And writing that was so much fun. It was this was the happiest book I ever wrote, which sounds funny to say because it's about coma, but it healed me. I loved writing it. I felt so much better. Just about 99.9% of all the post-traumatic stuff is gone now. And I just feel really, really grateful to Stella because she really got me through this and healed me. And I just love her.
Well, now that you've mentioned Stella, so your characters are Simon and Stella. You have more characters, but they're your main characters. And I loved that right from the beginning, you make a point of telling us what each of them wants. That's like one of the first things I learned in the book was that Stella really wanted to pursue her nursing career and have maybe a quiet life with a family. Yep. And she had always sort of told Simon she would go along with his desire for a larger life, a musical life where he would get his music out into the world and perhaps become famous. And I liked that very early on, you really establish what they want. So I wondered if you could talk about why it's important to let readers know what characters want, and particularly in this book, because I thought that was super important in this book.
That's a great question. I came late to learning about story structure. I always used to just wait for the muse and like write these books that would end up to be 800 pages. And then I'd have to look at them and say, what did I do? So about 10 years ago, one of my writing students asked me, did you ever hear about story structure, John Troubadour story structure? And I said, no, and I don't want to. And she said, well, look, I just have this tape of him speaking about it. Maybe you'd like to listen. I said, fine, send me the tape. She sent me the tape and I started to listen to it. And I felt like my brain was going to explode because it was so amazing. He was talking about, you know, finding the moral center of your novel, giving your characters choices, and always knowing that what they wanted was not necessarily what they needed because they had a misconception about it. And as soon as I read that, I thought, oh my God, I have to like explore this. So with Stella, I thought, wow, that would be real. So what she wants is this. She does. She wants a quiet life. She wants maybe a child, a home, just, you know, normal life, staying in one place.
That extension of what you mentioned before of her being very practical.
Yeah. And I thought, well, what's her misconception about that? And I thought, well, maybe her misconception is she can be more and maybe she wants something different. And then I thought about Simon. I thought, well, he wants fame. And I thought, well, what's his misconception about that? What does he really need? And I thought, well, Simon's whole misconception is he thinks fame is going to save him and is going to make his disapproving father approve him. And I realized, oh my God, that's so what he needs is to realize that it's more important to have just one person who really loves and sees you than to have these millions of screaming fans. And as soon as I figured that out, I got really excited because I thought, oh, this is going to be really a joy to write and fun. And it was. But it is. It's really important. The characters really have to want something desperately. And it's almost got to be the wrong thing. It's almost got to be the wrong thing that they want.
And how far were you into drafting with or without you when you came to that realization about what you thought each character really needed?
I'm afraid it was about 2 years. I do a lot of structural work before I start to write. My novels have to sort of marinate. And I have this story structure guru, Jeff Lyons, who I run everything by. And he always looks at it and says, no, makes me redo it 8,000 times. But it's really helpful because once I had that, then the writing sort of unlocked. But before I had that, it was just, you know, I spent days thinking, what does it mean to be famous? What does it mean not to be famous? And going down all these wrong roads until it finally felt right.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing I noticed about the structure of the book, and I'm not sure I'm going to really be able to put this into words because it was such a kind of a gradual experience reading it, but I felt like Stella's coma was part of your structure. And the way she comes out of her coma felt like a structural element. It felt very close to the structure of the novel. And I don't know if I'm putting that very well, but like her gradual awakening is just baked into the narrative. And first we have just the sense that she's there, which isn't necessarily anything anybody really knows for sure when someone's in a coma. Then we're in her point of view and we have a little awareness. And then we have a little bit more increasing like sensory perception, sounds, colors. And these are all spread out through different chapters. And so they, I'm sure, had to be placed where it made the most sense to you structurally. So I wonder, does that ring any bells for you, that idea?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I always looked at coma, and, you know, besides just being invested in the story, it was very much a metaphor for me in terms of everybody's awakening. You know, everybody is sort of awakening and in ways they didn't expect. And I wanted it to be very gradual because that's what happens to a lot of people, that it's like very, very, and it had to hit the points where other characters, it's hard to explain because I usually have it all graphed out. It's like when she, for example, when she wakes up and discovers this talent, it had to be at exactly the point where Simon's losing faith in ever, you know, being able to play rock music again in front of everyone. So it's sort of like as things got better for her, things had to get worse for Simon.
Yeah.
And I sort of like made sure the points had a kind of rhythm. And I want to stress this was a whole lot of trial and failure at getting these right over and over again. I must have rewritten this novel like 20 times.
And at what point in writing a novel 20 times do you graph out what you're talking about where you said you had the whole thing?
Oh, I do it. I do it right from the beginning.
Oh, you
like
do.
Right from the beginning. I always start out with like what I call a writer's outline, where it's like 30 pages of, I think this is going to happen, this. And as I'm writing, it all changes except for the basic idea that coma, the couple and her best friend and what's going to happen to them. And it, up to the very last draft, I had changes. Part of that is because I discovered new things, but the other part was that, you know, my own growth and thinking about this and then realizing, no, you know, maybe I can put this in because that's a better thing.
Yeah.
But it was really hard. I color coded. I made charts. I had post-its all over the place.
I think it's interesting that not necessarily with Stella, who goes through such huge transition physically and emotionally in this book, but maybe a little bit with Simon. What he really, and I don't want to give anything away, so I'm just going to say kind of something very vague, very vague. But what he really wanted, I really wanted for him too, for the longest time. And I was just like, so mad because there's a person sort of standing in his way that shouldn't be standing in his way. And I'm like, get out of his way.
Yes. Yeah. It's, you know, it's really funny because, well, the question you asked before about when I realized stuff, the thing is one of the pivotal scenes for Simon is towards the end with his dad. And at the time that I wrote that, all of a sudden my mom was dying. And a lot of the things that Simon says to his father were things that happened with me, with my mom. And I came to the realization that, you know, I was able to say to my mom when she died that, you know, I forgive you. I hope you can forgive me and I love you. And it was this freeing thing because you don't need the other person. You realize, you know what? You don't need the other person to say, yes, I forgive you or whatever. It's enough for you to say those words. So that kind of thing was like really important for me to put in there then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, after a coma, one might face big personality changes and even a change in aptitudes and capabilities and talents. Is that correct? Did you go through any of that?
No, I did not. And I was really pissed that I didn't. I mean, I know this guy who's a neurologist and a researcher, and I asked him a lot about comas. And he was the one who told me that we don't really know exactly what happens in a coma. We just know that the brain refires and sometimes it can rewire. Sometimes people come out and they're damaged and it's really terrible for them. But sometimes people come out and they're amazing. There's been cases of, you know, a woman woke up and she was speaking fluent Mandarin and she had no people in her history that she knew of who were Chinese. And she quit her job and she moved to China. There was another thing of a guy who had never played a musical instrument and he kept asking for a violin. They brought him a violin and he was like a virtuoso on it. And they don't know why this happens, only that it does sometimes happen. And I thought that was incredible. I don't really remember a lot of how I felt when I came out. I mean, I certainly did not have any extra talent that I knew of, or the only personality changes I had came from, you know, getting through the coma and recovering and normal changes that anybody would have where, you know, decisions about how to live my life and what was important to me. Those kind of changes happened, but nothing as drastic as.
Now you went into it as a very creative person. So did you come out being able to like fold laundry better or anything like that?
No, I wish I did. I wish I did. No, I didn't. None of those things happened for me.
How about your writing? Did that take a while to come back or was that okay?
Oh, yeah, that took a long time. That took a while to come back. First of all, because I was a new mom with a baby who didn't know me and I didn't know him. And we had to learn how to bond. And plus, I had to relearn how to walk. And I was just sick and we had no money. So I had to do all this awful freelance work to help support us. And it was a hard year. It was a really, really hard year.
That sounds like it. Oh, my God. Okay. Simon has a period early in the novel when Stella is still in the hospital where he loses his place in the band that he's always been a part of. Maybe he even founded the band. Yeah. And he's trying to write the kind of music that he's always written, but it doesn't come easily. And you write, it felt wrong, like he had never played before. And then he goes on to think that his former subjects were unworthy of writing songs about. So that made me think about two things. First, the sense of change in his ability and motivation almost kind of mirrors what Stella goes through.
Yeah.
And I loved that. I love when I find mirroring things within a narrative. So I want to talk about that. But then the second thing I wanted to talk about, and we can take these in whatever order you like, but it made me think of writer's block. And it just sort of made me think about, you know, have you ever had the experience of your fiction feeling unimportant or false and how to move forward if that's happening for a writer?
Okay. So the first part is about, I love when people discover new things too. I love to write about that. And for Simon, I loved it that all of a sudden he started to realize the first inkling was something's wrong. The pieces aren't fitting together the way they used to. And then he thinks, well, I can still like, I'll make music, I'll make songs. And then it doesn't work anymore. And I think that happens in life all the time. You've been doing something, you're comfortable with it. You think, oh, this is the way to do it. And then when you change, all of a sudden it doesn't work. And I like that because also like Simon didn't know what to do about it. And when you're structuring a novel, you always want the character to keep bumping up against the same misconception until he can't anymore. So even though Simon felt like, well, you know, these songs aren't right, he hadn't reached the point yet where he knew what was right. He just kept saying like, well, I haven't found it yet. I'll keep doing it. Writer's block. I think writer's block is something that's been invented to scare writers. I do. I think that there are all kinds of writer's block. Sometimes you're not ready to write, but you're still thinking. And to me, that's part of the writer's process. I always try to, it's an old Hemingway trick where I try to stop writing at a point where I'm excited and I can go back. Some days the writing is going to be crappy. or you're not going to feel like you want to write. That's not necessarily writer's block. That's when I get out all my charts and I'll do that kind of work. Or sometimes I'll just go online and look for photographs of ordinary people that look like my characters. Oh. But I think that if you give yourself space and you don't panic about it, then it just sort of will work itself out.
Great. Okay. That's really good. Well, now I don't know, maybe you've just addressed this, but what do you do? So first of all, how do you know when you're done with a chapter? And secondly, how do you know what happens in the next chapter? Now you're graphing, so maybe you already have it all outlined, but...
No, the thing about what happens in a chapter is really interesting because I guess the answer is I don't really know. I try to map things out. For me, it's easier to know when a chapter ends because I like to get in the heads of a lot of characters, usually like 3 or 4, sometimes 5. So it's like a chapter for a character. So then I think of each chapter as a little, you know, microcosm short story, almost like, okay, the first chapter I'm going to do like what Simon does when he wakes up and Stella's not waking up. That's that chapter. And I'm going to end it at a point where it's not, everything's not tied up. And it sort of almost ends with a question like, okay, he's rushed her to the hospital and they've told him to go home. Now what's he going to do? Cut. It's like, cut the chapter. Go in somebody else's point of view. It's hard to figure out how to do that if you're just doing like one main character, because then I don't know when it ends. You sort of want it to end at a point where something's been sort of resolved, but it's leading to more questions. So then the reader's going to want to keep reading on. So that's what I try to do. That's what I try to do.
Now, if you're just in a single character's point of view through an entire novel, will there be other elements that can play that same role? So like finish it in one setting and start in another setting?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, because my first two novels actually were first-person novels. I think what I did is I used time then. Like the first chapter was the character talking about, you know, here I am in the present and this happened in the past. I'm going to tell you that story. And the first chapter was her talking about, you know, how she grew up. And then again, I ended it with some kind of cryptic sentence like, no, but that would all change. And then I was able to go on to the next chapter. It's a little trickier for me anyway, when it's just one character, which is, I think, why I like to use a lot of characters.
I know. I think that's, it's very motivating to have different points of view to jump into. So what are your rules for different points of view? Do you have rules about like only this person can be in, we can only be in one head at a time? Each chapter, or do you allow each chapter to have scenes in different people's perspectives?
It's so funny because, you know, at my class at UCLA, we're actually doing point of view now and everyone's confused. And I keep telling them that, you know, because they want to label it like, is it third person omniscient? Is it limited? And I just tell them, you know, just try to think of yourself being in the story. You can always break a rule. You know, you can always, like, the only rule I tell them is if you have a single paragraph, maybe you don't want to be in three characters' heads in the same paragraph. You want to stick with somebody for a while. But I tell them to always read it out loud. And because for some reason, when I read stuff out loud, I can tell that, wait a minute, I'm switching point of view. And that's not, it doesn't feel right. I want to need to stay with that character a little longer. But point of view tends to drive people crazy, at least my students, because they're not sure of them. When they get sure of themselves, I think that then they'll just figure out, okay, I can do this as long as it sounds okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you already mentioned having had a moment where you forgave your mother and asked her forgiveness in your mind, right? So Simon has this strong fear of rejection that seems to stem from his parents, especially his father's early rejection of his career goals early on. And likewise, Stella has issues with her parents and the way that she felt as a child. She felt a little bit neglected as a child. But then I loved that you did this. You offer kind of alternative stories to each of those very dug in points of view. Simon's story, you offer a counter by giving us Stella's perspective on, you know, what his family life is like. And then in Stella's case, her mother and she have a conversation that's very elucidating. So I loved that. I like that you gave us their backgrounds, gave us their childhood memories, but also said, maybe not, you know.
Well, because I think like one thing that I've learned is that people are not always what you think they are. There are depths. And also I wanted to be really careful that nobody, unless you're a psychopath, wants to be a villain and be, you know, people are operating out of what they think is right. Simon's father may be limited, but he loved his son and he thought he was doing the best for his son, which, you know, turned out to be not so great, but there were reasons and stuff for that. And I've come to realize that people do what they think is best most of the time, unless they're psychotic, of course, but they do what they think is best. And sometimes you have to see all the sides of it. You know, it's kind of like my mother was incredibly loving and also incredibly brutal at times. And I've come to realize none of that was deliberate. It was sort of, you know, it wasn't deliberate. It was just sort of who she was. And she thought she was doing the right thing. And once you realize that people think they're doing the right thing, even when it's terrible, to me, they become so much more human and interesting. And it just sort of opens things up.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, going back to Simon's rejection or fear of rejection and anxiety around rejection, have you as a writer, or probably early in your career, did you experience a lot of rejection as a writer?
Oh, yeah. I always tell people when they think, oh, I'm never going to be published, they're like, okay, I have a story for you. My story is when I was 28, I won a Young Writers Contest and fame blew up for me. And I thought it was always going to be that way. And it was not. Second novel did a little less well. Third novel, my publisher went out of business. Novels 4 through 8, I got published, but I was bouncing around from publishers. Nobody knew who I was. Nobody. My friends were going up the ladder. I was like, barely made any money whatsoever. So for my 9th book, I was under contract. That was the book Pictures of You. And my editor called me up and said, we're not going to publish this. I'm sorry. And I said, what? Why? She said, well, none of us here think it's very special. And I said, what? can I make it special? Like, and there was a silence again. And she said, you know, we just don't think that you can. And I said, well, can I show you something else I've written? And again, there was this silence. And she said, I think we should really part ways, Caroline, but best of luck in the future, blah, blah, blah. And when I hung up, I thought, that's it. My career's over. Nobody's going to want to publish somebody with, you know, 8 novels and only the first one sold anything. And nobody knows who I am. I called up my agent in tears and she said, don't worry, we'll work it out. And I knew that we wouldn't. So I called all my writer friends, just sobbing, saying, I have to find something else to do, or I'll just write for myself. And one of my friends said, you know, I just got this editor on that Algonquin, and I really like her. Like, what if I tell her about your book? And I said, she's not going to want it. I don't make money. And my friend said, well, let me just call her. So she called the agent, the editor, and the editor said, well, that sounds interesting. Let me see the book. So I sent the book and she called me up and I said, look, I have to be truthful. I don't sell books. I haven't made any money in like 8 books. Nobody knows who I am. No one answers my call. And she started to laugh. And I said, why are you laughing? And she said, oh, that's going to change. We want to buy this book. And I thought, really? You know, are you insane? So they bought that book. And I watched how they marketed it, and it was amazing. They took that book, and first of all, they got it in 6 printings 6 months before it was even published by just their publicity machine. It made the New York Times bestseller list its 2nd week out. It then became a Costco Penny's pick, which is this big deal. And the interesting thing was that editor who had rejected it called my agent and said, would Caroline like to come back to us? And my agent said, no. So in a way.
Did she ever call you?
No. So, but that's okay. You know, that's okay. And the thing about it is I always say, you know, it was actually really good that that happened to me, because I spent all these years, like less, you know, after the first fame, which was fun, desperate for it again. And then when I had it again, it didn't mean what I thought it was going to mean. I mean, it was sort of, yeah, you know, I was calling me, I was in the paper and all this stuff. And I just thought, well, the good thing about it is like, now I know I can write my next book and I'll have a little bit of money and that'll be nice. But in terms of, oh, this means something big, I kept telling people, well, maybe it means something big right now, but you never know what's going to happen. A writer's career is up and down and up and down. I don't know how the next book is going to sell. Maybe it'll be big. Maybe I'll be down at the bottom of the heap again. And it doesn't matter. If that's, I tell all my students, if fame is what you're going after, you're going after the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And don't be a writer, because that's not what it's about. Mm-hmm. It's really not what it's about. So I'm actually glad in a weird way that that stuff happened, because it just taught me a lot about what matters and what doesn't.
Yeah. And also, I think that there's the tendency, it's such a tenuous career, right? And there's a tendency to think, take this thing that's been offered to me and this is it. This is all it is. And then if that thing goes away, you feel like there's nothing, there's no other things.
Right.
But that's not necessarily true. So
that's not true. That's not true. I, you know, my husband's a music writer, and he put me in contact with a lot of musicians. And I talked to some ones who had been famous in their youth, and now in their 60s, it was kind of pathetic, because a lot of them were, I mean, I talked to somebody from the Jefferson Airplane who was still like wearing like tight little pants and a little tube top and carrying a bottle of vodka. And I thought, this is pathetic. This is really pathetic. And then the people I really loved were people who had been famous in their youth. And now they're just sort of, you know, they were so happy to still be able to play in places, and they weren't the big venues anymore, but they didn't care.
Right.
And they were sort of acting their age and singing age appropriate songs. And those were the people I really liked. And I thought, oh, they have full lives, you know, and authentic lives.
Yeah. Now, With or Without You has a lot to do with sacrifice in relationships. Mm-hmm. And on the cover, the cover copy says, what we owe the other people in our lives, right?
Right.
And I loved this line. Do you mind if I read a line?
No, go ahead.
This is Simon. When he looked at her eyes, he didn't have a clue anymore what she was thinking, or even if she was thinking about him, which made him feel strange and shy and unhappy. And that's a perfectly reasonable sentiment, but I thought there was this wonderful, subtle little, like, he was used to her thinking about him all the time. And I liked that line. It's tossed in very quietly, but I loved his shock at not being considered.
Yes. Yeah, they all have to like sort of realize that their relationships are not what they think it is. And, you know, they all sort of had like, their relationships were not wide open enough. It was sort of predicated on, okay, I'm Stella, I'm going to do what you want, Simon. And Simon like, well, I'm Simon, so you have to do what I want to support me. And that's the way our relationship works. And relationships change and they grow. And the trick is to be able to grow with your partner. And that's what makes people stay together, when you can embrace and encourage change rather than thinking, why aren't we like we were when we were 20?
Right. No, it was just great. It was, it's funny because the book is very much a story of two people, maybe three people, but it gives you a lot to think about. Now, when she comes back, this was another, I'm just mentioning a couple little details that really stood out to me. When she's starting to come back, her friend Libby gives her a puzzle. It's not a very difficult puzzle. It's not like a 2,000-piece puzzle, but, you know, she's working on the puzzle. And at one point, you mentioned that it is slowly growing into something that makes sense. And I thought, that is such a lovely metaphor for her own life coming back to making sense. I love that.
Oh, God. Yeah, we when the pandemic started and we were all in lockdown, my husband and I bought puzzles. And like easy puzzle, like 300, you know, ages 2 to 20 or whatever. And there was something really satisfying about seeing those pieces come together into something. And you felt, okay, the world is falling apart, but at least we have this puzzle that we can put together.
This makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so we already talked a little bit about change, but I want to get more into that. So writers are told that character change is vital in a novel, and this book is actually just the embodiment of that. It's about change, character change, how people do change, and not just due to coma or trauma. The story about their friends Bob and Carol, for example, was great because it sort of reminds us that people change.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, that story about the couple who suddenly changed was actually based on these friends of ours. When I first met my husband, I asked him, like, well, what kind of relationship do you want? Because I thought, let's get our cards out on the table.
Right.
He said, oh, I really want to be like my friends, you know, blah, blah, and blah, blah. They've been together for 17 years. They talk about everything. They still hold hands. They've changed. They're wonderful. I thought, oh, this is great. And then a few months, you know, after we'd gotten married, we got a phone call from
blah, blah.
Caller Amy, you know, and she called us up and she said, you know, I'm leaving Richard. And I said, why? What happened? And she said, all of a sudden he changed. He started getting into bodybuilding and he shaved all the hair off his body. And he set up a gym downstairs and he was taking pictures of himself. And the last thing he did is he entered a competition pulling the Mack truck with his teeth.
Oh, stop it.
And they, yeah, no, seriously. So they, you know, they divorced and he went on to another woman. And we were also struck by that, thinking, wow, like, how can somebody change like that? And it's been like 6 years since then. And every once in a while, we look him up on Facebook and now he's into bicycles. He cycles like a crazy person. So he just reinvented himself. Those things do happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I loved that you reminded us of that. And not just keeping us in this kind of little bubble of your main characters, but also showing us, like, we all change. We all do.
Yeah, we all change.
Maybe not like Bob, but...
Right. But we do all change, yes.
Caroline, I like to ask my guests what they've been reading lately that they might recommend to listeners.
Oh, there's this wonderful book that's coming out by a friend of mine. It's by Stephanie Ganji, G-A-N-G-I. It's called Carry the Dog. It's about a photographer and what happened in her childhood and about vantage points of how we see things. And it should be out next month, I believe. And it's just wonderful, just absolutely wonderful book.
Oh, that's great.
I just started reading Lorna Maud Comes Home. It's Diane Johnson's new book. And she's wonderful. And the book is also really wonderful. I'm only like 10 pages in, but I can tell right from the start that I'm going to love it.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks. And then what are you writing next?
Oh, okay. Well, I actually just turned in this novel, which is tentatively called Days of Wonder. And it's about, I actually wrote out what it was about so I would know if I ever asked. It's about a troubled young woman who's early released from prison. Uh-huh. She was supposed to be in prison for 25 years. And instead, she's let out in 6 because they botched the case. And she's desperate to find the child she gave away and the boy she had been in love with when they were both 15. And they were both charged with an attempted murder of his father.
No.
And it's just, again, it's about change and who we think we are and who others think we are. And it's about how you reinvent yourself.
That sounds great, too. Wonderful.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I never know. I just sort of, when I'm done with it, then I'm on to thinking about the next book. So.
Okay. Now, my last question always has to do with advice for writers. And in your case, I wanted to ask you about one aspect of this book. Stella has lost herself through getting into this coma, and she has to start over emotionally and find herself. And she's a person who's changed drastically. So I wondered if you had any advice for writing a character with a challenging internal life?
Yeah, I do actually. That's a great question. I think a lot of times people tend to try to over-explain something. And I always tell people, when you're stuck and you're not quite sure, think of it almost like a silent movie. What would the actions that people were doing silently show you about who they are. It's sort of like it's easy for somebody, a character, to come out and say, I hate my partner. But what could you, if you couldn't have dialogue, you could perhaps show the person coming in and, you know, the way he looks at his partner shows you what he feels. Or maybe he picks up a photograph of his partner and just sort of turns it face down or puts it in a drawer. I always think that if you go for the actions, you go deeper than if you're trying to explain why he didn't feel this, why he wanted this. It you believe it more. It's actually, you know, the old thing, actions speak louder than words. They do.
Wonderful. That's great advice. Okay, I want to just mention again that the name of the book is With or Without You by Caroline Levitt, my guest today, and published by Algonquin Books. Caroline, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much. What a totally great interview.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Caroline Levitt. You can learn more about her work at carolinelevitt.com. So for writers who are listening, this week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Caroline Levitt. Write a page about two people in love without mentioning passion, desire, kids, or any words associated with love. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. And of course, the pandemic has not wound down. It's now clear. It's still going strong. I hope that you are healthy and well. I hope that you are able to write and able to follow your favorite authors. Despite if their launches are still virtual, authors really can use our support. So try to support the authors whose books are coming out. Attend their in-person events. Attend their online events. Read their blogs, follow their book tours, find your way to their books however you can. And for all of you who are trying to write, please always remember that Write the Book offers a prompt every single week. And given the fact that even when I run reruns, I try to present an original prompt. So there are close to 700 Write the Book prompts on the website. So if you go to the website, writethebook.podbean.com, you will find a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview for each week. And you can go back in time and look at lots of different prompts. And hopefully they help you in your writing. I would love to hear your feedback about the show. The show's changed format a little bit. We haven't quite finished transitioning, but the shows are going to get a tiny bit shorter, a little bit different approach to how we conduct the conversation. Sometimes I'll have two people on in a certain week. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. Let me know what you think of the new format. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on all the places where you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my website, which is SheLaughsWithoutUs.com. That's just a really easy mnemonic for spelling my name, SheLaughsWithoutUs.com. Or you can go to ShaylaConnorShapiro.com. That works too if you can figure out how to spell it. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and do please talk about it and tweet about it and whatever else. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.